From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. If you've seen the terrific new documentary, Love to Love You Baby, you'll be thrilled to know that it's co-director and Donna Summer's daughter, Brooklyn Sedano, is here with me today. First of all, Brooklyn, thank you so much for doing this. And something I mentioned to you when I saw the film is what the movie makes clear is your mother was always, like I said to you, a cabaret performer, that she always connected with audience first and foremost.
Yes, no, I think that's one of the things that made her unique was that she took her foundations in the theater and really brought them to her stage shows. But even more so, she really intrinsically was a character actor in some ways. And I think she saw every song as its own individual monologue and approached each song with the emotion and the character that it needed in order to connect to the audience in a deeper way.
You're talking about her ability to sort of bring that storytelling to songs, but it's also the power of the eyes, and you start the film off with us seeing those eyes and all those mm-hmm. who know those album covers, and we're always aware of her looking at us. I think that's part of the connection a lot of us who grew up with her feel, even though we didn't know her, that she seemed to be communicating in the way that an actor would.
You know, it was really important when we had that opening shot. Roger, Ross Williams and I, who I directed the film with, it was like, okay, this is it. Because we really went back and forth about what the opening should be for a while. But we knew once we had that, we're like, this is it, because this allows people immediately to understand how this film is going to go. And that you really are going to be seeing it through her eyes and through her voice. And so we really just felt that that was the most impactful.
She was a persona. And the thing we sort of really feel when she's not performing is the difference between her, just, you know, her countenance becomes much more playful. Her voice, mm-hmm. her speaking voice is a different register. Because I think those songs, in the way, one way or another, dealt with intimacy or were about intimacy. We didn't know her. It's the thing that sort of hit me in ways I hadn't expected before. And I just found it really powerful.
Well, I think there was always this element of mystery. And I think that is part of the craft, right? Is giving people that element of mystery. But it was also really how she operated in life. She was very private and she had a way to kind of compartmentalize things in her life. And, you know, when I was going through some of this, I really understood in a deeper way that that's how she needed to do things in order to survive and survive some of the things that had happened to her and to move beyond them. And so it was one of her gifts, but also was some of the things that were the most complex in terms of her personality.
I mean, she really broke away with that in the 80s. She was clearly crafting another persona for herself. And all these were about women who took pride in the way they got through the day, which I thought was really interesting. And then this kind of shift, because it went from this sort of nighttime persona to a daytime persona.
I don't think I've ever viewed it that way, but that's exactly right. And I think, you know, in terms of my mom's songwriting, which I don't think most people understood that she really did write a lot of her biggest hits, but she works hard for the money, particularly in terms of her creativity and her artistry, you know, it was part of her every breath. And so inspiration could strike at any moment. And I think when she saw that woman, this bathroom attendant, Onetta Johnson, I believe her last name was, she saw her. And I think that was one of my mother's gifts, is she saw people and then was able to translate that into a song or an artwork or some kind of artistic expression. And, you know, I think that in that moment, she gave voice to a feeling that a lot of people were feeling then. And to be honest with you, is still timely now because women have not reached gender parity.
And especially in that period when she was recording, where women sort of didn't have gender parity either. And she was so often thought of as a tool of producers or right. record label executives. And I just thought that being, you know, the first person to sign to Geffen, as you mentioned in the film, but also that shift in the 80s is saying, I'm going to be a grown-up in my songs from now on. I mean, there's this almost infantilization of me in terms of the way the media deals with me, and I'm not going to be that person anymore. And I thought that was really fascinating, because that seeing that character, that persona rise as you were a kid, must have spoken to you in a really interesting way.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I grew up feeling that my mother was very empowered and very confident as a person, just in our everyday life. She ran things at our house, you know? And so to really go back, peel back some of the layers for her to get there was really interesting to me, because as I got older, I could see through some of that confidence, and I could see through some of the things that the complexities in which she was working through still. But it gave me and my sisters a really great lesson, because I think in the end of the day, we realize you don't have to be a perfect person for you to still use your gifts, or for God to still use you, or you to still feel impactful and successful in life. And, you know, I think that was a real foundational thing for my sisters and I.
It's the treatment. We're talking to the co-director of Love to Love You, Donna Summer, Brooklyn Sedano. You can also see the show at kcrw.com. When we spoke at the screening a couple of weeks ago, one of the things I said to you is, having a chance to have seen her live, what was amazing too is that if you saw her perform, you saw that she was a cabaret performer, because it was kind of almost a three-act piece. And each of these songs would take us to this kind of conclusion, which became really spiritual and really big. She basically told you where her career was going if you saw one of those stage shows.
One of the things Roger and I discussed early on was that we wanted it to feel immersive. We wanted it to feel like going to one of her shows, because she was a storyteller, and there was always a beginning, middle, and the end. And she would take you on this really emotional journey. You would have all the feelings. You would jump for joy and be dancing with joy. You would feel like you were falling in love. You would go to church, and then you would go back to the club. You know, I think it was really kind of this full body experience. And, you know, a lot of the choices we made in the film were really trying to emphasize that creative thought.
There is so much assurance in that voice when she's singing those songs from Hair that we see in the documentary. And I can't tell you how I have a great ear for German, but there is so much belief that you go, wait, she's not German. Right. But even the way she breathes, and I mean, it's not an American breathing rhythm that she's doing. And I watched the film again. I thought you can actually sort of see the influence of sort of like Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht on the way those shows were put together. I mean, it's this fascinating sort of nexus of American and German culture.
You know, she learned German in 2 months of time. But I think that speaks to her gifting. You know, she had an ear. We would always make a joke even afterwards that whenever we went to another country or with somebody from a different culture, she would adapt that person's accent just without even realizing it. So it was really the way that her ear worked. And she literally learned German in 2 months and spoke fluent German, fluently after that. And so her time in Germany and Austria and in that whole area really was so instrumental to who she became, you know, just even in her mindset and in the freedom that she felt being a young Black woman there without the confines of, I would say, you know, the American racism and things that were going on in the same way. She was able to expand herself culturally in a way that I don't think was afforded to her in the States in, you know, 1968, 1969. So that period of time was really instrumental with her worldview. And she really was very European in nature for the rest of her life.
I mean, you're absolutely right, because I was thinking about that going through album covers, and I'd be embarrassed to tell you how many of her records I have. but looking at these pictures and listening to some of the music, again, I just found myself thinking about, you know, like Three Penny Opera and the kind of stuff that Bertolt Brecht did, and this idea of sort of making your persona sort of this commenting on what the audience is experiencing as they're experiencing it. So it becomes this sort of conversation and yes, something other than that. I mean, there's all that in the way she worked.
You know, it was funny, even as we got older and my sisters and I would, you know, be a part of the tour and we would go show after show and we'd be a part of the process, we would comment on the audiences, you know, and some audiences would be more engaged than others. And when an audience was engaged with her, it was magic. And it was transcendent. And I think that was really a part of her gift, this rapport that she had with people. Even if it was a big amphitheater or a big stage, people still felt that intimacy from her, that she was talking and speaking or singing directly to them.
The people who you guys got to talk about her and to talk about the kind of impact that her work had on them, like the Elton John, I mean, talk about corralling those people.
Thankfully, my mom had a lot of collaborators and people that are themselves very artistic and really great collaborators or friends. And, you know, we spoke to Elton John and Giorgio Moroder or Pete Pilotti, you know, and Giorgio and Pete were, you know, they were the trifecta. They had a really great creative relationship and friendship. Giorgio is still a family friend to this day. We spoke to many different people. We spoke to Kelly Rowland. We spoke to Barry Manilow. We spoke to David Foster. You know, there were so many different people from her walk of life that had these interactions with her that were impactful. However, when we really boiled it down, we really felt that this needed to be told as much from her perspective and from the family's perspective as possible. And so we ended up not really using as many of those interviews as hard of a decision that was to make, but we felt that there was more power in letting her performance and letting her own voice tell her story and for the audience to experience in real time just how gifted she was without necessarily somebody else talking about that.
It's such a unique story too, because as you were saying, that she went to another country, that she immersed herself in that country and its culture and absorbed things. I mean, there's, you can't look at the album cover of Bad Girls and not think of Three Penny Opera. I'm sorry. I went to the wrong high school, but that kind of impact, I mean, what she brought from that culture and made that a part of her work, I mean, I think opened a lot of doors. And it's fascinating the way the movie uses imagery to tell us that story.
Two of my mother's, I guess, idols or people, women that she looked up to were, you know, Mahalia Jackson, but also Josephine Baker. And I think that she is really the culmination in many ways of these two women and bringing the strength and also the stage persona and all of the European imagery of what Josephine Baker represented and just even that banana dance, you know, the banana skirt and all of those kind of things. So, you know, she really tried to learn from people. She was always a student. She was never too big to not learn. And I think that her curiosity for life and the world around her really is what helped her continue to move forward and to always be engaging because she was willing to learn.
We'll take a break. My guest is the co-director of Love to Love You Down This Summer, Brooklyn Sudano. It's The Treatment, which you can hear at kcrw.com. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking to, well, I hope her mom didn't know that she's starting a movie called Turn the Beat Around. Anyway, my guest is Brooklyn Sudano, the co-director of Love to Love You, Donna Summer, which is on Max. I could always hear her Boston accent in her vowels. And that's a fascinating reminder of growing up as a young woman of color when she grew up in Boston and the story she tells about that scar on her chin.
Yeah, Donna. I think growing up in Boston was extremely foundational to who she was. And, you know, I do think that she grew up in pretty turbulent times in Boston. You know, there was a lot of things that in my research that I really got a deeper understanding for where she was coming from in that moment. And then with that deeper understanding, just amazed at how much she was willing to go outside of her box. I mean, she was in a band called The Crow, which was an all-white psychedelic rock band, and she was the lead singer, aka The Crow, of an integrated band, you know, in 1966 or 1967 as a 16-year-old. So she was really forward-thinking in many ways, even when her environment didn't always reflect that. And she was willing to take those risks, you know, but I also do think she understood that because of some of the dynamics in Boston that she couldn't stay there. She moved to New York, was a part of, like, you know, the hippie scene there, which is where she connected with Bertrand Castelli, who cast her in Hair, which brought her over to Germany.
I mean, there is this aspect of sort of ascendancy, looking for something bigger, that comes through in a lot of the songs, especially, again, as we were talking about those songs after she went through that disco period. But even those songs, I mean, especially now, you can't listen to Love to Love You Baby and not hear the power that she's doing all those sort of simulated groans and moans from her diaphragm, that there is something performative in that, that this just isn't some sort of infantile cooing for effect, that she's
right.
that there's calculation in those choices.
Yes. And I think that was something that was really important to her and something that she really took time to strengthen. You know, there were stories that she would sit in her bedroom and lay on her bed as a child and hold her breath. And that's how she would strengthen her diaphragm in order to be able to really gain that strength and that vocal control, you know, and then she was able to sing in church and all of that. But, you know, I think that a lot of her musical choices as she progressed, you know, she had Love to Love You and then the song, you know, Try Me, Try Me, which is also kind of like this airy kind of vocal. But then she's like, okay, well, I'm going to hit you over the head with MacArthur Park. Or Could It Be Magic? And I'm going to show you what I can do with my voice. And, you know, so she was always pushing it. And then she's like, okay, well, I'm going to do Bad Girls and Hot Stuff, which has this rock edge to it. So she was always even vocally trying to change the dynamic and push herself and reveal different parts of who she was and what her gift was.
The song Winter Melody is almost a show tune in terms of the arrangement and the way she sort of goes from sort of strength to being beseeching in that. There's always this sense of the awareness of the power of her voice.
Well, yes. And I think she realized, you know, that was also, I think, part of the dynamic that occurred with Casablanca Records and Neil Bogart at the time, because I think she began to really understand, yes, the strength of her voice, but what that means on many layers and on many levels, and that she needed to empower herself with her voice fully. And that happened to do a lot with her songwriting, you know, and the song particularly Dim All the Lights was very important to her. And she really, it was the first song that she wrote completely herself with, you know, no other co-writers. And she really believed in it and wanted that song to really reach its full potential. And when that was mitigated by the release of Enough is Enough, I think that was really one of the telltale signs, like, oh, I don't think I'm going to be able to really fully use my voice with these dynamics, and I need to break free from it.
And by the way, I should say, it's the treatment. We're talking to the co-director of Love to Love You, Donna Summer, which is on Max, Brooklyn Sudano. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. I think it's so interesting that she became this whole other thing after leaving America. But as you show in the film, those family dynamics and the way it affected you guys still, I think, sort of informed this kind of melancholy that ran through a lot of her work.
For me, it was really important to tell the whole truth, for you to understand what she had come from and been through, because I think it's also part of the reason why she was able to connect so deeply to people. Even sometimes with a simple dance song, people would still end up crying, you know, on the dance floor. That doesn't necessarily happen with everybody's music. And I think it was really important to show all of the sides, because it just, it allows you to understand just how much it took to get to where she needed to go. And it was a journey. And I think that, you know, she had to sacrifice a lot, particularly as it came to, you know, mothering my older sister, Mimi. She was really on the forefront of her stardom and had to make some really strong choices to leave her with my grandparents. And being a mother and being a working mother understood that struggle to a certain degree, but never to the degree at which my mom had to make that choice. And, you know, there were ramifications of those choices, and not all of them were happy. And, you know, I thought that it was necessary to peel back the layers of that part of the dynamic.
To me, I mean, that's the essential part of the story. The two different kinds of ambition battling with themselves, the ambition to have a fulfilling career, but there's also this ambition to create family life, because there's so much video in the movie of the way you guys connected for holidays and occasions and when grandparents would come around. And just to have that only be or often be a fleeting part of her life, you know, I can't hear a song like Faster and Faster to Nowhere and not think about all these things pulling at her.
100%. And I think it was, you know, really a foundational element. What were those home videos? Because we wanted to really give a sense of who she was in those unguarded moments. And I feel like that's where you really get a true sense of her personality, where all the other stuff is stripped away. And in many of those home videos, you still see that music and her creativity are very much central. You know, it was who she was. She was a creator. She was a performer. You know, we make a joke that we were like living in a musical always. But, you know, I do think that it took her some time to really reconcile this idea that she knew from a very young age that she felt called by God, really and truly felt like God told me I was going to have this gift, that I was going to be famous and not to misuse it. So that there was this sense of responsibility to this destiny. But what that also was sometimes in conflict with her own mental health and her own sense of being a good mother and being there for her family and, you know, being there for her spouse. So, you know, it was one of those things that really was a push-pull for a very long time. And I do think as she got older, she was able to find the balance.
Is part of this the reason you turned to performing, because that thing was always around? We see the idea of play acting and playing at roles. And again, we can hear her, the actual timbre of her voice when she's at home versus that voice she used on stage. Although as she got late in her career, she started to do away with that voice. But this idea of assuming roles and jumping into character and this exuberance in performance, is that something that shaped you and turned you to what you do now?
100%. I think myself and my sisters included, in some ways, have taken different facets of my mother's creativity and kind of run with it. You know, I've been an actor and now directing. My younger sister, Amanda, is in a band with her husband called Johnny Swim, and they go on tour and are on the road. My sister Mimi is a creator. She has her own jewelry line and does a lot of home goods and things like that. So our foundation was creating a moment and creating beauty and creating art and expressing that in every aspect of life. And my mother was very much an artist in every aspect of her life, was whether it was cooking dinner or decorating the Christmas tree or designing a bedroom or a costume. Because of that, she would set us to say, all right, we're going to play this skit and you're this person and that you're that person. And we would just kind of create these own little, like, you know, mini scenes just for fun, just to be silly, just to have a good time. And so I think that was very foundational to each and every one of us.
What the film feels about to me is there's this constant sense of evolution for her. And yes, we're talking about ambition, and she just had this need to sort of keep changing. And it's evident in the pieces of the stage show that you have in the documentary. Again, we can hear her do away with that little girl voice that she would use as she got later in her career, and she wouldn't pretend to be two different people so much anymore. And I wonder if you felt that was in some part her basically saying, I trust the audience enough to know that I don't have to pretend to be this thing that's not a grown woman anymore, that I can be who I am, and they will accept that.
Yes, I think there is definitely that. And I think that did come with her own empowerment and age and her understanding that she had reached a certain level of success and being able to find the balance. You know, I always say that the persona of Donna Summer and that the Queen of Disco, it is a part of her. You know, it's not that it was just put on. It is a facet of who she was, but it wasn't all of who she was. And so I think she was able to meld all of these things together in a real way. You know, she was naturally very funny. She was always telling jokes, you know, and I think that's why she put so many of the little skits and things within her stage performance. That was naturally who she was. I do think as she evolved as an artist, she became more and more comfortable with all of the facets of herself.
And it was interesting too, because I think there's this ambition to sort of evolve that led to that phase that where she dealt with her Christianity and said things that was misquoted and even saying things that, that really sort of inflamed her core audience. And that's, to me, that you chose to leave that in and to not ignore that. Talk about the decision to include that part of her life.
Roger and I discussed it at length about how to really encapsulate that moment, because it was something that kind of dragged on for many years. And I think it was really important for us as a family to acknowledge that, you know, an off the cuff kind of thing on stage was hurtful, and but it wasn't intended to be hurtful. It wasn't intended to be like some kind of diatribe or anything like that. It was really kind of like supposed to be funny, but it wasn't funny to many people. And I think we, you know, my father really within the film also says like, they did make a mistake. They should have nipped it in the bud to let people know like, oh, wait, no, that's not who I am. That's not what my intent at saying this was. And I think people attached a lot of extra meaning to it because she did have this reaffirmation of faith right around the same time. And so I think it just really kind of snowballed into a much bigger thing than I think they even realized at the beginning moments of what it was going to turn into. So I think looking back, they would have addressed it way, you know, much more quickly to say, oh, wait, let's hold your horses. Not, this is not what you think that it is. However, you know, I think it was really important to bring it up. I don't think it's something that we could have ignored, but you know, this film, so much of it is about acknowledgement and healing in many different ways within the film. And this was another point of that, was to acknowledge, to say, look, this caused hurt. We understand that. She understood that. And we want there to be healing. And, you know, thankfully, there was much healing after many years. And I often spoke to Roger about it. I was like, listen, my lived experience was not that controversy. I've only ever known love and joy and a mutual simpatico relationship with the LGBT community, with whether it be the fans or my mother's colleagues or friends or whatever. So to go back and do that was really sometimes really tricky for me, because it was just like, this is not who my mother was. But I knew that I had to really, that we had to acknowledge that this did really cause deep pain for some people. And this film is about healing, and we hope for that.
My guest is Brooklyn Sudana, actor and now documentary co-director of the film Love to Love You, Donna Summer, which is on Max. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis. I appreciate you having me.
Actor turned documentary filmmaker Brooklyn Sudana on her film Love to Love You, Donna Summer, about her mother, Donna Summer. It's available now on Max. More music and history at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. He had a great dedication to his work. He was completely absorbed and serious about his music. All else came secondary to us getting that sound. That was Sonny Rollins, not about himself, but about Thelonious Monk. But it should have been him about him. What did Sonny Rollins say about himself? Well, that he barely felt fully adequate as a musician. I have with me today the author of a terrific and compelling new book that you can't put down, although this is the last time I make this joke, you can barely pick it up. The book is Saxophone Colossus, The Life and Music of Sonny Rollins. My guest is author Aidan Levy. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad you chose the title Saxophone Colossus, just because that album is really, I guess, the center of the target. It's really the bullseye of his career in a lot of ways for me.
It's a classic. It's probably his best known work. Although what's interesting, for Sonny, it was just another day in the studio. Just another short session in Hackensack at Rudy Van Gelder's studio, one of the greatest recording engineers to ever record music. And it was recorded in Van Gelder's parents' living room.
But also that title too, because it's kind of mammoth and self-deprecating at the same time. And also, to me, I think it's sort of key to who he is, because there's that island musicality in it, but also you can sort of feel the concentration. It's this sort of nexus point that I think Randy Weston talks about when he talks about Rollins.
He grew up listening to Calypso music. His mother took him to Calypso dances in Harlem, and she used to sing him St. Thomas as a lullaby. She was from St. Thomas. Many people on the islands knew that song by a different name. Randy Weston, whom you just mentioned, recorded it as Fire Down There. It was also recorded by a Calypsonian named Louis Walcott, who later became known as Louis Farrakhan. He recorded it as The Charmer. Sonny's background in Calypso goes all the way back. That's his heritage. And he wanted to bring that music into the jazz tradition.
To me, I think this is the most daunting thing about obviously writing the book, or at least obvious to me, is tackling that part that's really central to the story that people have about Sonny Rollins, that we know about him, which is the bridge. And you break into fighting the bridge and the bridge and after the bridge. But that felt so fresh because there's so much sort of undercurrent going on there. So all these sort of tensions and insecurities start roiling in him and lead to that moment of him doing what he did on the bridge.
Yeah, well, Sonny was a child prodigy, and I think one of the reasons he felt so inadequate is from a very early age, he met Miles Davis when he was a teenager, and he was playing with some of the great geniuses of this music. And I would count Sonny as one of them. But to be on stage with Miles Davis as a teenager, to be in Thelonious Monk's apartment practicing some of his new music with him. He was at Bud Powell's house as a teenager. Jackie McLean was his childhood friend. He grew up with all of these people. He shared a cab ride with Billie Holiday. They were playing opposite each other on a gig in New Jersey. So I think he was awestruck by them when he first encountered them, and he remains awestruck by them still. In about 1959, Sonny had finally risen to a level of prominence in the jazz world and in the music world in general, where people considered him the greatest tenor saxophonist of his generation. But Sonny didn't believe the hype. Even though he had all of these accolades, he was always at the top of the polls at this time, he felt that there was something in him that he wasn't getting to. There was a sound that he heard in his head that was never coming out the bell of the horn. And he made what many people found to be a shocking decision, which is that he suddenly vanished. And in 1959, you still could vanish. It's a little bit harder today. This is the pre-digital era. So nobody knew where Sonny Rollins was. There were all these rumors about him. Some people thought he'd cracked up. He lost his mind or something like that. Nobody knew where he was. He disconnected his phone. You couldn't reach him. And it turned out that he had gone into seclusion on the Lower East Side where he was living at the time. And he found the perfect practice space, the Williamsburg Bridge. He was looking for a woodshed in jazz parlance to do some shedding, shed a second skin. He started practicing in his apartment, but Sonny Rollins practiced more than anybody. He could practice 16 hours a day. The problem was the neighbors. So he started looking for a new woodshed. And one day he was walking through the Lower East Side, and he looked out across the East River, and he saw the bridge. And he walked up the pedestrian walkway, and he thought, this is the perfect woodshed. And it really was for him, because Sonny had one of the biggest sounds in the music at that time. But when he came off the bridge a couple of years later, his sound was even bigger because he was competing with subway trains, tugboats, sometimes harmonizing with them too. So yeah, that's kind of the legend of the bridge, that he was up there rain, sleet, or snow, like the Postal Service. And it wasn't a place that anybody else would have thought of to practice. But for Sonny Rollins, the Williamsburg Bridge was heaven.
It's the treatment. We're talking about heaven with my guest, Aidan Levy. He is the author of the impressive biography of Sonny Rollins, Saxophone Colossus. You do a bit of detective work in the book and confirm something that most of us kind of had a sense of, but I want you to talk about that, and that's Sonny's playing on Tattoo U.
Yeah, they wanted him for Tattoo U to play these saxophone solos, and there was this fabled meeting of Mick Jagger and Sonny Rollins, and as the story goes, Sonny said, "What do you want me to do here?" And Mick Jagger danced it out. Sonny plays on Neighbors, Slave, and Waiting on a Friend. And I think that Waiting on a Friend, the solo there, is just one of the all-time great saxophone solos that you hear on a rock song. But Sonny did it on the condition that he not be credited on the album. Of course, he didn't realize at the time that any jazz fan, any music fan worth their salt would instantly recognize this as Sonny Rollins. Incidentally, though, Sonny didn't recognize himself immediately. He heard it in a grocery store one day, and he thought, "What is that? That actually sounds okay." He said, "Oh, wait, that's me."
But you also had something in the book that speaks to his connection to being a person of color. When he said, after he met with Jagger, I think you said something like he didn't relate to them because he just thought they were derivative of black blues, which I thought was really interesting and a sign of who he was.
He felt that that music was cultural appropriation and he didn't identify with what they were doing. What happened after he made the record is they asked him to go on tour, and the tour for Tattoo U ended up breaking records for attendance. And they offered Sonny, I think, seven figures to go on tour. And his band at the time knew about this as a possibility, and they were nervous that they'd be off the road if Sonny was with the Stones. But Sonny said no, he didn't want to be trotted out with the Rolling Stones. He wanted to play with his own band. And he felt that as Sonny Rollins, he had a moral obligation to do that, to represent jazz as an African-American art form, and to be out there as Sonny. And at that time, as part of a shrinking list of jazz giants who were still living. So yeah, he turned down the Stones for the tour.
Again, this sort of push and pull. I mean, there's a fascinating section when you write about sort of his contretemps with Wynton Marsalis and how he dealt with that. Because I was thinking too, the first section of the book, when you're writing about one of the reasons he takes to the bridge is because he did feel it need to go back to school, because not intentionally, but not just Miles Davis, but Coltrane was sort of saying you need to get back to school. And then to have this kind of thing revisited with Marsalis saying the kinds of things he said about him, and Sonny just responding, and I think the most level-headed and optimistic way possible, sort of speaks to the way he's kept on moving, which is what the book is about to me. It's about momentum and momentum in the writing, because there's this constant sense of momentum in his life.
Wynton Marsalis has done so much for the music. At the time that this concert, or two concerts, I should say, took place, he was in his early 20s, and he had only somewhat recently exploded onto the music scene, winning Grammys for jazz and for classical. And he had a certain, maybe, sense of arrogance at that time. And Sonny had this series of concerts that he did, mostly at Carnegie Hall, that some people thought of as the Sonny Rollins Invitational Series, when he would pass the torch onto someone from the next generation. One point it was Wynton Marsalis. Wynton had made some inflammatory comments in the jazz press about some of the elders, and a lot of people weren't very happy about that at the time. And after he met Sonny at Town Hall in New York in 1983, right in the middle of the concert, Sonny suddenly collapsed on stage. And nobody knew what was going on. He was rushed to the hospital. it was okay. I get into the book what was really happening. They got back to Sonny that someone in the Marsalis camp said, you know, Sonny claps because basically Winnan had blown him off the stage. Sonny heard about this, and when they had the rematch, as it were, Sonny taught him a lesson. If there was any tension there, it was all water under the bridge. They reconciled. Sonny wrote a song that was in tribute to Winnan Marsalis, also to Winnan Kelly, Winnan's namesake, called Winton. And you can read a poem by Winnan Marsalis about Sonny Rollins. They definitely reconciled if there was any real tension there. But yeah, I mean, it was a lesson. And there was kind of like an intergenerational transmission going on there. There was wisdom imparted, the kind of wisdom that could only be imparted on stage.
It's fascinating to see somebody, to read him talking about wrestling with his doubts, because there is always so much confidence in the playing, isn't there?
Oh, for sure. I think Sonny would go into a flow state when he was on stage, and all the practice behind that would inform everything he did. But basically, the way he describes it, he would just let the spirit move him. He was just a vessel, is sort of how he thinks of it. But as soon as he got off stage, he would always say he could do better and that he's going to do better the next time.
I have to ask you what he said when he saw the book.
I wasn't there. I can't tell you exactly what he said, but I think he was probably a little bit surprised. He saw the first draft of the manuscript, which was about twice as long as the published book.
We should say the book literally weighs in at over 700 pages.
The book is a brick. It could stop a bullet. So I sent him the manuscript, and he called me on the phone and said, listen, I got the book. I've read a little bit of it. I'm not going to read all of this. And I thought, well, why is he saying that? And then I said, well, why don't we just talk through the whole book together, and you can make corrections or additions. Let me know what you think, and I'll summarize everything that happens. And he said, that would be great, actually. So we had about 10 more conversations or so about the manuscript where we just went through it. So when he saw the finished book, he did tell me that he had a positive feeling. I was happy that he seems to appreciate the tribute.
Well, I mean, the thing that's so fascinating about the book is he's constantly searching, and that never goes away, even at the very end of the book. I mean, with the prospect of COVID and everything, there's this immense hunger in him. I guess I want to ask, and maybe a kind of a last question, is if that was this thing that you first connected with, because I actually feel it in St. Thomas. He's trying to expand people's idea of what that song is and what Calypso is.
I was struck by his spirituality, but by the never-ending quest, his search for the lost chord. That's how he thinks of it. And it comes from an old vaudeville tune that Jimmy Durante sang, The Lost Chord. And Sonny took the idea seriously that you could actually find this if you just worked hard enough, if you practiced enough, if in a certain moment you were inspired and the muse struck, in a sense that God could speak through you. Yes, I was inspired by that. And that's something that struck me immediately when I first spoke to Sonny Rollins in 2012. We did an interview for Blue Note Records. And it's something that I do hear on St. Thomas, was that push to go deeper, always to go deeper. And you hear Max Roach playing a calypso rhythm at the beginning of the song, and Sonny bases his solo around the first two notes of the melody. And after he plays some choruses, suddenly you hear this cymbal crash and Max goes right back into the swing time. And it makes the connection between calypso and hard bop, which had never been done before in that way. It's a beautiful arrangement. And I think it exemplifies Sonny as a composer, but also as a searcher.
Well, that's why I wanted to talk about that title. And because I think it's certainly on a superficial listening, because he's always so astonishingly energetic and confident, you can certainly take away a kind of a sprightly reading of it. But it's such an aggressively musical piece, I mean to say. I mean, it's just such a complex piece of work. And I so often think of him not with the bassist, but with the way drummers responded to him. And you would get at that in the book, too.
He was tough on drummers. The drummer was in the hot seat. And he worked with so many drummers, hired and fired so many drummers. But every drummer I talked to, even the ones that he had let go, sometimes unceremoniously, sometimes in the middle of a performance, they still said that it was a transformative experience. And one drummer that lives out in Altadena, who's still active, Roy McCurdy, he started to get notes from Sonny after a performance. And some sets would go for an hour and they'd play one song and he'd take it way up. So McCurdy needed to be in impeccable physical shape to keep up with Sonny. And sometimes Sonny would kneel down, just kind of squat in front of the bass drum so that he could really internalize the sound of the drums. But he started getting these messages from Sonny in his hotel room when they were on tour, saying, you know, if you could try to keep up, basically. And then the next day, McCurdy would go and do his level best. And then he got another message saying, "Dear Roy, thank you. Sonny Rollins." In his hotel room. But yeah, the other lesson that the drummers learned was they always had to bring a change of shirt to any concert.
My guest is Aidan Levy. His book is Saxophone Colossus, The Life and Times of Sonny Rollins. Aidan, thank you so much for doing this. Really, it's a terrific book.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sonny Rollins is the Saxophone Colossus. The impressive book of the same name is by Aidan Levy. It's out now. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. Writer Sam Wasson's latest book is Hollywood, The Oral History, co-authored with Janine Basinger. For The Treat, he offers authorship from a musician whose songs are the gritty melancholy of the movies.
I'm Sam Wasson, and this is The Treat. My favorite thing, if it's a book or movie or whatever, music, I have to go for the music of Tom Waits.
Well, you gassed her, and a wheel, with your arm around your sweet one, your Oldsmobile, nailing down the boulevard. You're looking for the heart of Saturday night.
Being an Angelino, I hear the sound of this city. I hear Raymond Chandler and I hear heartbreak. I hear the late nights. I hear everything that turns me on about this wonderful, maligned, lonely, silly town that I love so much.
Then you comb your hair.
His ability as a writer, just as a writer of language, his humor, and the sound of heartbreak, you know, the sound of a man's heartbreaking, I particularly love. That feral, I don't know, animal desperation, and also, with the animal, such intelligence and playfulness. I love the storytelling, you know, also. So I love Christmas Card from a Hooker. I can't remember the whole time. Christmas Card from a Hooker in Minneapolis. Charlie, I'm Pregnant, Living on 9th Street. I mean, I just, the story, the troubadour aspect of him, I love.
Charlie, I'm Pregnant, Living on 9th Street. Right above a dirty bookstore. Of Euclid Avenue.
I mean, it is a world with attention to light and to character and obviously story. I mean, I'm just thinking about this now for the first time. You know, that's an atmosphere, you know, obviously. I would love to know what movies Waits liked. I'm sure that's available somewhere. That must be written about. But I wonder.
It says that it loves me, even though it's not his baby.
To me, he's infinite in all directions and thrilling every time I connect with his music.
Gave me a ring that was worn by his mother. It takes me out dancing every Saturday night.
Hollywood, The Oral History is the recent book by Sam Wasson and Janine Basinger. Sam's treat is Tom Waits. You can hear past treats, such as New York Times writer Joe Coscarelli, on an indie film documentary at kcrw.com/thetreat. The treat captures the music of the soul, from movies to style to books and music, from artists who fell under their spells and passed that along to us. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Help as usual from Anna Buss and Laura Kondarajan. To better days, everyone, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Savor The Treatment wherever you select your podcasts.
How do you like that? Charlie, I almost went crazy.